Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome to another in our series, Voices from the Archives of the Mark Steiner Show. This time, we'll hear an interview with Mark Bowden, author of Black Hawk Down and Killing Pablo, about his book, Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam, a nonfiction work about the Iran hostage crisis in 1979. And then we'll talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch about At Canaan's Edge, the third and final work in his series, America in the King Years, about the life and times and the world of Martin Luther King Jr. and the influence it had on American life, politics, and our future. So join us as we talk with these two great American authors right after this break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. My guest this hour is Mark Bowden. That name rings a bell to many of you, of course, because of Black Hawk Down, but he's done many, many other things. He writes for many journals. He's a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He lives in the Philadelphia area, but he comes here once a week to teach at Loyola College.
Right.
Loyola University now, excuse me, not college. And he's back with us today because of his latest work, Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam. That has come out and taken the country by storm. And Mark, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
And Mark and I were talking before the show began about this book. And what was the word you used to describe yourself, Mark, as the way you write?
I write nonfiction novels.
Nonfiction novels, which I think was perfect, actually, the way you've written this book and Black Hawk Down as well. Mm-hmm. But this particular piece, I have two questions to hit this off with about the beginning. The typical question. I mean, you clearly, when you wrote Black Hawk Down, it was something that was still vivid in the imaginations of Americans and the war in Somalia. And so it was almost current when you did that. But you've gone back now to 1979.
Right.
Almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. Why did I do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was about that? Was it because of the issues with Iran that we're facing? What was it that drove you to this particular piece of our history?
With any writer, I think a lot of things kind of come together that make a particular project gain traction, you know, and at any given moment, there are a number of directions that I can go. And then for whatever reason, you know, I end up going in one. This case, in working on Black Hawk Down and the next book, Killing Pablo, I met a lot of the men who were part of Delta Force, who were, who went on this rescue mission, the failed rescue mission to Iran. And, you know, they kept saying, you should write a book about that, which I actually did not want to do. But I was a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1979 when this episode happened. And after that rescue mission failed, I had a really good friend and a great reporter. He's now the managing editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, Bob Rosenthal, who was assigned the task of finding these guys who went on the rescue mission and writing their story. And poor Rosie struggled with this story for months and could get nowhere. These guys would not talk to anybody. And here I was, 15 years later with these actual guys saying, God, we'd love to tell our stories. And so part of me felt like, you know, how could I not do this? I mean, this is just a real opportunity. But this was a mission that never really got off the ground, so to speak. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought in the context of this whole episode, the takeover of the embassy, I've always been fascinated by stories of captivity, of people who are imprisoned or interrogated. It just struck me as a pivotal moment in modern history. I was surprised to see that no popular historian or journalist had ever done a book about the whole episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it just grew on me to the point where I felt like it was something that would build on my strengths, the things that I'd done in the past, and would make a dramatic story and would be important.
The two things that you were just talking about also ran through my head as I was reading this book and going through it again. And one has to do with the juxtaposition of things in this book, and one has to do with the Delta Force, mm-hmm. which you write very powerfully about in this book, and tragically. And one has to do with the world of Iran and the United States today. And what you're writing about here really touches on where we are now. I mean, the military in America, the idea of the Delta Force that dealt with Pablo, and as you wrote in Killing Pablo and Pablo Escobar, what happened here in Iran, I mean, it's become almost the center of the world for our armed forces, or these Delta Forces. I mean, they are, I think more and more this is going to be unfold as the role they're really playing throughout the world. And also the power of that moment. I mean, the subtitle of your book really is where we are now. I mean, mm-hmm. this was like the opening salvo.
Right.
It's like Fort Sumter.
You know, in the Civil War
in some ways.
And I think that's only come into focus, Mark, in the last 4 or 5 years, particularly since the September 11th attacks. Because I think, you know, looking back on this episode that happened in 1979, it's always been viewed as, I think, sort of a bizarre episode, almost like an aberration. Mm-hmm. It took place in the midst of the Cold War, and it just seemed to come out of left field. I mean, suddenly there's this Islamist revolution, and the United States is being called the Great Satan, and it just didn't compute for most Americans. And I don't really think that once the hostages came home, everything settled down, it was seen as something indicative of the future. It would just seem to be sort of a bizarre episode in the past. Now, though, I think we can see that this Islamist fundamentalism, which we're fighting all over the world, our first real confrontation with that was in Tehran. So in that sense, and also for other reasons, in the sense of special operations, military stuff, I mean, this is where it all began.
Now, when the hostages were taken, I mean, you start this book off, I mean, almost the ordinariness of the day, people mm-hmm. beginning their lives here and waking up in the embassy and taking care of things in the embassy surrounded. But a couple of things happened on that morning. I wish you kind of just talk about that. I mean, first of all, what was taking place in Tehran at that moment in the embassy with Bruce Langenoff in
right.
Talking to the foreign ministry, so Charles Affairs, who was running the embassy at the moment, was not there, and the other folks who were there.
Right.
And back in Washington, I was really fascinated by the questions I never even thought about, that Carter actually asked questions. President Carter asked what would happen
right.
if we let the Shah in for treatment when he was kicked out of Iran, and would they take over our embassy? I mean, he actually asked those questions,
right.
which I never knew.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, our whole dealings with Iran during that period are evidence of just spectacular intelligence failures. I mean, we failed to anticipate that the Shah would be overthrown, that he would flee the country, and then afterwards failed to anticipate the danger of maintaining this 27-acre embassy compound in the heart of what had become a virulently hostile anti-American city. We were still sort of hopefully believing that the United States could reestablish diplomatic ties with whatever new government formed in Iran. And it was wishful thinking because Iran was such an important country to us in that region. It was our bulwark against Soviet expansion, you know, to the south and to the oil fields to the south. And we were actually content to make peace with whatever Islamic regime developed in Iran. But as it turns out, they weren't too content to deal with us.
Take us back to that moment, though. I mean, I think what happened when we talk about the Shah, his being overthrown, his relationship with America, and what happened at that exact moment. I think there are a lot of people listening to this broadcast who were not alive at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Never don't think about the hostage crisis then right. because it's ancient history. But just take us back to that moment for a minute.
Well, after the Shah was overthrown,
who'd been backed by the Americans for
right, he
40
was our
years,
puppet,
30 years, right.
And for 25 years, it was a really unusual revolution that brought together forces from all directions in Iran. I mean, the opposition to the Shah had grown over years and years, and an alliance had formed between sort of unusual partners. You had leftists, you had communists, you had socialists, you had nationalists. And you had the Muslim mosque network, which had built itself up as a real center of opposition to the Shah. So once the Shah was overthrown, these various factions began struggling amongst themselves to determine what kind of government Iran was going to have. The Ayatollah Khomeini returned from Paris after the Shah fled Iran to millions of people dancing and celebrating in the streets his return. But he didn't seize power. He went to the holy city of Qom, and he established a provisional government just to tend things while a constitution was written. And the provisional government was made up of primarily secular politicians, leftists, some of them nationalists, socialists. So what happened in the takeover of the embassy was that the radical religious students, the Islamists, feared that this provisional government was going to climb back in bed with the United States, destroy this vision that they had for the perfect Islamist society, and return the Shah to the country. So that when they took over the American embassy, it was really, you know, this radical Islamist group, part of what had carried out the revolution, asserting itself and trying to prevent what they saw as a betrayal of their cause.
What's fascinating, the people that you describe here, I mean, you do write this like as if it were a novel kind of unfolding over the course of those months when these hostages were held. And the interesting thing is that the hostages that were held who worked at the embassy in Tehran, the CIA operatives who worked there spoke no Farsi.
Right.
But three of the other embassy officials who do the little kind of work came out of the Peace Corps, actually, two of them,
right,
spoke fluent Farsi.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was almost made no sense.
Well, but it does if you understand the culture of those two agencies. And I think that, I hope that that's changed today. But certainly 25 years ago, people who went into the Foreign Service tended to be academics, tended to be people who were in love with foreign cultures, foreign languages. They had, in the instance of the two characters, Michael Matrinko and John Limbert, who were Foreign Service officers there, had originally come to Iran in the Peace Corps. John Limbert had married an Iranian woman, had, you know, taught at an Iranian university. They were
loved
lovers.
Iran. He loved
they
Iran.
Were lovers of Iran.
Right.
The CIA is a military culture. The guys who end up in the CIA often, you know, come out of the military, and they are, you know, they view the world very rigorously through an American lens. And the best of them, you know, become experts in the countries they're in. But in this case, the three CIA officers who were in Tehran had only been there for a combined total of 4 months,
right.
Spoke no Farsi. It was ridiculous.
But the people you describe, you spend the time on a lot of them, but there's some of them who you really kind of delve into in a much deeper way. And Limbert and, am I going to say his last name right?
Matrinko.
Michael Matrinko. Yeah. Were the two of the Farsi speakers.
Right.
Both came out of the Peace Corps. Both really loved Iran and hated the American relationship with the Shah. Did not like what America's relationship was with Iran and back in the Shah. They were both opposed to it, which is one of the reasons I think you said Limbert didn't want to go back to Iran to work until
Iran was its own country, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And we're very excited, both of them, about the revolution, about the prospects for change in that country. They were excited for their Iranian friends and for the potential of the country and excited about the opportunity to reestablish ties with this country on a more equal footing, instead of the United States having a puppet government in Iran, two fully independent governments dealing with each other as equals, and that was exciting to them. And then instead, they found themselves thrown in rooms, tied to chairs, interrogated, accused of being spies, and basically being scapegoats for the very policy that they deplored.
They despised, and that. It was interesting what you just described. We had a woman on here a bunch of months back, several women who've written books, Iranian women, about their world. One was a Jewish woman who came out of that. She was part of these demonstrations and part of that world. It was a really broad-based kind of movement in the beginning that this actually helped narrow down into its
right
Islamic
yeah,
power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a real fear of the religious right, which was just one faction in the revolution.
The Iranian religious right we're talking about.
The Iranian religious right, yeah. The
right.
Islamists, you know, that they were afraid that their secular co-revolutionists were going to sell them out. And when they seized the American embassy, it rallied popular support behind this banner of anti-Americanism and really helped leverage the mullahs more fully into power. And the students who took over the embassy held daily press conferences at the American Embassy compound with documents that they found in the files, and they would use these documents to smear their political rivals. So prominent secular politicians would find themselves branded at these student press conferences as traitors, as spies, as collaborators with the Americans, just because their name showed up on Michael Matrinko's Rolodex, you know, which a lot of Iranian officials' names would. So they did. So it's like McCarthyite tactics, essentially, to run the secular political leadership out of power, and ultimately, you know, help to put the mullahs firmly in control.
Now, you try to make sense of the chaos of the moment in the beginning of all of this, mm-hmm. when they stormed the walls of the embassy and
right.
came in, and people were in different sections of the embassy at that moment.
It's an amazing day, and you know, a tremendous amount of confusion as thousands of Iranian students are pouring into the compound over the walls. You know, any American or any foreign embassy in any country, including those in our country, are there as guests of the host government. There's no way that an embassy can protect itself from, you know, a large crowd in any country. The Marines who stood guard at the embassy, their job is basically to hold off an unruly crowd until the local police or the local mm-hmm. militia comes to protect it. In this case, no local police, no local militia showed up to protect the American embassy, and they were taken hostage by all these students. I think that the leadership of the embassy wisely decided not to shoot at any of the protesters because it probably would have triggered a bloodbath.
There was that interesting scene you read about where the Marine was holding them off. They had shot the tear gas off. The Iranian students were coming in. Mm-hmm. The Marines had their shotguns poised, had a shotgun poised, and the head of security—
Golosinski. Yeah,
came down. He's screaming, "Don't shoot!" The Iranian students are screaming, don't shoot.
That's right. And wisely, you know, Golosinski realized that they may shoot and kill some of these protesters, but they're going to run out of ammunition. They're going to get overrun and ultimately, you know, be torn from limb to limb. I mean, you can imagine the furor it would have incited for this relatively small group of Americans to have killed some of these protesters. So the embassy was surrendered. Without a shot being fired, and yet it was celebrated in Iran as though they had stormed and taken the most formidable fortress imaginable.
The personalities in this thing were also very different. I mean, there were those who kind of stood up very forcefully to the mm-hmm. and stoically
right.
to their captors.
And not all did. I mean, Michael Matrinko is an example of someone who I think...
And he was not a military attaché. He wasn't CIA.
No, he was a foreign service officer, but they just assumed... Because he spoke fluent Farsi. And his job, he was a political officer. His job was to try to make friends and try to understand what was going on in a very interesting time in a very interesting country. And he would file reports with the State Department, whose job it is to better understand, you know, these countries. So that was what Michael was doing. And he was really loving his job. As he describes it, being a political scientist during that ongoing revolution was like being a geologist camped on the rim of an active volcano. So for him to be tied to a chair and thrown into a room and deprived of an opportunity to do his work, to be accused of being a spy, was just infuriated him. And so he nursed his anger, really, through the entire 15 months, using his knowledge of Farsi and Persian culture to basically insult and annoy
and ridicule his captors,
aggravate them, and he found himself beaten frequently and really badly treated as a result.
What struck me about the difference between, and then I'm going to turn to the hostage takers.
Right.
What struck me was that people like Roeder, who was the Air Force attaché, who was the military attaché to the embassy, or deputy military attaché,
right,
and Matrinko, it's almost as if what got them through those months of captivity, was their response to it was to stand up and spit in their face.
Right.
The pain they received, the blows they received from their captors, it was almost as if the pain is what kept them alive every day, saying...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, you know, the biggest threat, I think, in those circumstances is to give in to the fear when there was tremendous fear that they could be executed or that they would never come home. So the biggest fear is to give, I think the biggest danger is to give in to the boredom, to give in to the fear. And so different hostages came up with different strategies for coping with that. And this one, anger, confrontation, was one that a few of the hostages used, none more than Michael Matrinko. John Limbert, who we've discussed a few minutes ago,
right.
was another Foreign Service officer who happened to be one of the other Farsi speakers. And his approach was to... embrace his guards, embrace the hostage takers, not collaborate with them against his fellow hostages, but show them who he was really. And, you know, his love for their culture, he ended up teaching his guards about their own history, translating Farsi documents into English, helping them with their homework, because a lot of these hostage takers were, in fact, students. And so, you know, his goal was to make himself a person, to them, so that if it did come down to them executing people, that they would think twice before they shot him.
And then you had other folks. I mean, one of the things that really was upsetting to read about him, just because, I mean, people react to these things all very differently. But
Joe Subic, you're probably
Joe Subic
of,
and
right.
Rosen both.
Yeah. Well, Joe Subic was a Army sergeant who is blessed, I guess, or cursed with an overabundance of a desire to please people in authority. And when the embassy was taken, he immediately began trying to be helpful to his captors, to the extent that, you know, while the top officials at the embassy were not eager for their captors to know what their position was at the embassy or what their job was, Subic was leading, right on the first day, leading these hostage takers around, identifying all of his colleagues for them. This is Colonel Chuck Scott. He's the military liaison. This is Colonel Tom Schaefer. He's the defense attaché. These are jobs that guaranteed that these individuals would be more roughly handled, more roughly treated. So he earned the scorn and anger, you know, of his fellow hostages right from the first day.
And then it was Mr. Rosen, who was the press attaché.
Right.
Terrified.
Yes. And, you know, he was, again, he was one of the three or four who spoke fluent Farsi. He began to give in, I think, or to be crippled by his fear, really, of what would happen. And he began having physical symptoms of terrible anxiety and stress, which he would complain about. He suffered. I mean, he physically suffered
yeah.
while he was there. And as a result, they gave him drugs, which he started to take basically for a lot of the time that he was captive. He would zone out, you know, just taking these drugs, much to the chagrin of his roommate, Dave Rader, who really relied on him for conversation and support. And so different people responded in different ways.
Now, the people who took this embassy, I mean, you start the book off with Hashemi and preparing to go to his meeting, and it was the Muslim groups who took over the embassy were actually split inside themselves over what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there were different factions inside those groups, but they were right. a fascinating group in their own right.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, they had banded together because of their fear of these secular student organizations, most particularly the Tudeh, which was the Communist Party, which was the best organized and funded of the student movements in Tehran. So the Islamic students formed a group that they called Strengthen the Unity, which was an effort to bring together the five campuses, the five big college campuses in Tehran, all the Islamists from those various campuses into a single organization. And that was the group which included Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the current president of Iran, who planned the takeover of the embassy.
But it's also interesting to me that the people who took the hostages, when you describe in the end of your book, when you talk about where the hostages are now and where the hostage takers are now mm-hmm. individually, and you're going to see them, that so many of the people who took these hostages are on the outs
right.
with the government. They're on the outside of power.
Well, I think you would see it, you know, in the United States today if you were to talk to a group of student radicals from the 1960s and 70s. And, you know, as they mature and they're middle aged today, I'm sure not all of them look back on things they said and did as favorably as they don't feel as good about it today. And that's similar there. I mean, you have people like Ibrahim Ezgarzadeh, who's the man who came up with the idea of seizing the embassy, who today feels it was a bad mistake, realizes that the embassy takeover is the event that effectively leveraged the mullahs fully into power and created this theocracy, which he now does not like living in and has become an outspoken critic of. He's been in and out of jail for his criticism of the regime. And I think it was on the 15th or the 20th anniversary of the takeover of the embassy, he actually gave a speech at what they now call the Den of Spies, the old American embassy, denouncing what they had done 20 years earlier. And
they carted them away.
They did. He ended up spending a little time in jail for that.
But it's almost as if the people who led this takeover of the embassy, at least a lot of them, the way I read your book, one of them was the editor now of one of the papers that was
Abbas
banned.
Abbas
Abdi, who's and one of the major critics of the regime,
right?
Who's been jailed many times,
mm-hmm.
that these were like the young revolutionaries who were dreaming of this utopian world they wanted to build in Iran,
right.
saw the Americans as the worst enemy on the planet.
Right.
And they've just been completely disillusioned by the revolution they helped create.
Yeah, they have. I mean, and that happens, I'm afraid, in revolutions throughout history. I mean, it, flush with idealism and religious fervor, you know, you have this idea that you're going to create a society that overcomes all human failings and, you know, where everyone will be happy and the government will be perfectly just. And in fact, a government becomes what governments always become, somewhat corrupt, definitely more interested in accumulating and keeping power than in achieving any really important social goals. You know, you have right now, I mean, Matrinko is fond of saying, never confuse the mullah establishment in Iran with a religious organization. I mean, these are networks of families. I mean, people inherit the titles of their parents. And over time, you know, they become like any other oligarchy. They are the rich and powerful, and they're there to hang on to their power. And that regime has become increasingly unpopular in Iran.
I wonder very quickly how you recreate some moments. Well, there's one moment that sticks in my head is when they took the hostages out and were acting as if they were going to execute them.
Right.
And you had them all lined up against the wall the way they were lined up. And,
right.
And the feelings were going through each person and what they were thinking as they thought they were about to be killed. It was a very chilling, really chilling moment.
Frightening moment.
Frightening for the reader.
Well, I think what you do as a reporter is realize that this is a very powerful and dramatic moment, and I need to try to elicit from all of the people who were there as much detail as I possibly can about what went through their heads, how they felt, what they did. There are times in writing a story, and I try and teach this to my students, where the writer needs to speed up time, and then there are times where you need to slow down time. And
you slowed it down here in some ways.
Yes, this is something that you want to tell that story second by second by second.
Right.
And fortunately, there were enough hostages who went through that ordeal that I'm able to draw on 20 or more separate accounts. It's funny, when I was in Iran, I asked Mohammad Hashemi, who was one of the primary hostage takers, about this. And he said that it was a lie, that none of the hostages were badly treated at all. And I said, how can you say that? You know, I've interviewed 25 years later 20 to 30 people whose memories are exactly the same, and interviewed them in different times and places, you know, all over the country, and they're all lying. And he says, well, you know, sometimes things happened over which, you know, we had no control. But that was the most that he would say. He wouldn't admit that they'd actually done this.
See, I think people realize how badly treated these hostages were. I mean, how...
Right.
Some of them.
Right. And in fact, you know, for this book, some of the hostages, former hostages who told their stories, have done so for the first time. And they tend to be the more higher ranking officials at the embassy. For instance, Tom Ahern, who was the CIA station chief, has never spoken before of his captivity.
But you got to.
Until this book. Right. Michael Matrinko, who we've talked about already, one of the most abused of the hostages, has never told his story before. It's never been written. So there's a lot of these people are really coming forward in this book for the first time.
Did you speak to Matrinko in Afghanistan or here?
No, I spoke to him here. On several occasions. And in fact, I was able to find a long interview with Matrinko that was done in 1981 by another journalist that was never used for any publication or anything. So it was interesting to jog his memory by the things that he was saying 20, 25 years ago.
Guess the Ayatollah is the book by Mark Bowden, The First Battle in America's War with Middle and Islam. And Guess the Ayatollah is a book, I think, that tells all sides of this story. The interviews he did with those who took the hostages themselves, the story of the Delta Force, the afterword that really kind of focuses on who and where we are now and where they are now. And Mark Bowden, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here again.
Okay, Mark.
Thank
My
you for
pleasure.
The book. Thank you so much for the book. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. It's my pleasure this hour to talk with a man who I've known for a while, I guess since the existence of this program almost, when he came out with his other books in this trilogy. We're talking, of course, by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch, who wrote The Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 63 and 65, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 54 to 63, and At Canaan's Edge, of course, Parting the Waters was the first book that won the Pulitzer for him, and At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, the final book in this trilogy, 65 to 68. And Taylor, welcome. Pleasure to have you in the studio.
I'm glad to be here at last.
At last. Free at last.
Free at last.
Congratulations on finishing the trilogy.
Thank you.
You finished this trilogy. I think just a little background here before we dive into your book. You started this trilogy 24, 25 years ago?
1982.
And you thought it was going to be this one volume at first, from what I've read. We've never talked about this, but it turned into this work of 23 years worth of writing and work. I mean, how did that happen, that you started out with this one thought and then it just turned into this voluminous piece?
Well, the context of it was that it was proposed to be a one-volume work that would take 3 years, which was three times longer than I'd ever spent on any other book before mm-hmm. that. So I knew it was a big project, and it was defined from the beginning as America in the King Years, a storytelling recreation of the civil rights era. So my own definition is what really set in motion the formula for a much bigger book even than I conceived, because I had this rule that I think in race relations we learn by stories that are human more than by ideas that are abstract, and that most of the labels in racial discussion of militant and racist and all that stuff really don't convey anything except people's sense of their own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to do storytelling, and I knew it would take a lot longer. But I had no notion that I was going to have to do so much education in order to be able to...
Your own education, you mean?
Of myself.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to present things from as many different points of view as came to bear in the movement. You know, people were at each other's throats over the meaning of freedom right from the beginning. And people of so many different kinds, you know, bishops and presidents and FBI directors and sharecroppers and terrified people. This book starts out in, you know,
people, Lowndes County, Alabama.
Yeah, people terrified because there's a rumor that if the preacher shows up and even mentions the vote, the Klan's going to come in the church to get him. And they do. That world, you know, is pretty far away from most of us. And to be able to tell it from the point of view of the people who are in it. Means you've got to do a lot of work that's not in libraries. Because my theory is libraries preserve what people are comfortable with. And we're not comfortable with any of this. So I had to do a lot of interviews and, you know, a lot of archival work. So it just kept expanding into religion and into politics, but most of all into the lives of human beings in really deep struggle.
People have called this the King biography, but I think that's a real misnomer. It's much more. I mean, King is the centerpiece, but it's not a book just about the biography of Martin Luther King.
Oh, absolutely not. Even in the proposal, I said I wanted to do people that I admired, like Bob Moses of SNCC, and certainly the presidents, Kennedy and Johnson, because this era comprises Vietnam, encompasses Vietnam, and huge wars and that sort of thing. So there are lots and lots of other characters, but. The preface to Parting the Waters, I still stand by. It said, you know, this is not, strictly speaking, a biography. It's a narrative history of America during this time, which I think was defined mostly by the Civil Rights Movement and King at its center. Not always at its head, but always mm-hmm. at its center, in the sense that people, even who are ahead of him, trying to get him to go on the freedom rides, are pitching for his ear. And the people who hate him, like J. Edgar Hoover, are trying to figure out how to undo him. So he's the in the middle of the wheel.
Now, it's amazing to me that just always jumps out at me again when I was reading the book, that the period of time we're talking about with Martin Luther King and the period you look at in American history was 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying to us in some ways in this book, that these may be 13 of the most pivotal years in American history, in the American world.
Oh, I think so, and it's just so uncanny that
that these 13 years coincide exactly. I mean, he takes his first church and he launches his career just before it began, just before the bus boycott happens. And then by the time he's dead, really the movement is in disintegration. But it has set all these things in motion that I think are still coming to the fore for today in empirical life, in movements about what equal rights really mean that affected women and who washes dishes and who's on TV and who's treated fairly and who gets to vote and all these other things.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute before we come back to the heart of the book. I mean, what do you think it was about that era? What do you think it set in motion that we're still wrestling with today? What are the things that you've come to from writing this book when you look at 2005?
Well, I think it comes out of World War II. It comes out of American history. It comes out of the American Revolution. What does freedom mean? I think that's the only story there is in America. What does freedom mean, and are we true to it or not? And how do you run a government that way? And World War II was all about that in race and fighting the Nazis and that sort of thing. And it raised all of the racial issues to a new height. Can we say we are defending freedom against the Nazis and then reimpose segregation at home, which is how the Brown decision was ultimately decided, and struggle of all that. And that intellectually put segregation outside the realm of American ideology. And yet it was embedded in everyday life. You wake up the next morning, it's still segregated. So what do you do about it? And I think that really kind of set off all of this struggle. But once people start struggling with what's the nature of equal citizenship, why have we never had a female Episcopal priest? You know, people started struggling in all these, why can't women go to Princeton? You know, that's in these hearings today.
Right.
And it's so well decided now that people think it's a ridiculous issue. But if it were so ridiculous, it would have happened 100 years ago. And, and you know, during this period, it was still a very dubious proposition that women of any race should attend most of the private colleges in the United States, should be allowed to go. And they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that question in a different way. On a liberal tide that is still kind of lapping up on the shores when liberal is not even a polite word in public society.
People run from the word.
So you have these hearings today with the guy saying, well, gosh, I can barely remember that. Well, yes, you can barely remember that. But there was a time when it was a hot issue in the United States, and even when churches came to the brink of schism over whether or not they were going to allow females to hold office in the church. Now it's gays. You know, that's gay people. So we've moved, still struggling about what's the nature of equal rights and how do you treat people and fairness as a legacy of the civil rights struggle, in my view.
My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize winning author Taylor Branch, who's finished his last in his trilogy called At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, this volume, 1965 to 1968. I want to jump to the middle of the book, and because you talked about freedom, and you have a chapter in your book that talks about how the symbols of liberty began to change in America.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to go back and talk about what led up to that, but I mean, you're talking about in 1967 is when I think this chapter started.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about Meredith and South and Reagan and Nixon and the whole question of race in the South, and how that began to change the notions. And we see the reverberations of that with Democrats and Republicans and who's in power today. But you clearly saw that as a very pivotal moment.
Yeah, it was 66, actually, the year that Reagan was elected governor. And June of 66 and the Meredith March and the rise of black power. The official position, and not just of Nixon and Reagan, but of a lot of white people, beginning in that year, was that the race issue was done,
right?
That it was settled, and that there was no political future in it. Now, of course, America was still segregated then, and there were enormous struggles over how to enforce it, and they had just begun to enforce the desegregation by sex of American jobs. The want ads in American newspapers were still help wanted male, help wanted female.
That's right.
And people forget that. And they had just been struggling to get rid of the help wanted white and help wanted colored or black and Negro in other areas. But we were so eager because it was an uncomfortable and politically difficult issue, and particularly because the new Republican Party in the South, which had never really existed and was springing up in opposition to civil rights, they couldn't try to reimpose segregation, but what they did was to say that the end of segregation was done and that it was a burden on the South and that it was a lesson against overreaching big government. Nixon's position was that the race issue is over and done. There's no future for either party, and the lesson is that the Democratic Party endangered the nation by getting too involved in the issue of race, which, of course, is exactly what Lyndon Johnson had feared when he signed the two Civil Rights Acts. Mm-hmm. I'm giving the South to the Republicans who don't even exist in the South, not only for my lifetime, but maybe for yours.
He knew that.
He said to Bill Moyers. Yeah. And he did it anyway, which I think is one measure of Lyndon Johnson that I believe shines through in this book. He was very sincere about what he did. He knew he was risking his political future there.
You delve deeply into the characters of both Martin Luther King and Lyndon Baines Johnson. I mean, really kind of looked at these men in all their complexity, which got some people angry, which we'll talk about in a bit about the King parts. But it was also Johnson's complexity. I told you that when I read the Selma speech and that you can describe here from in a moment, it blew my mind to read that again because I think a lot of us back then, at least I was, so busy vilifying Johnson in the early 60s and 64 and 65, not to think of the complexity of this man and what he wrestled with. And I think that's something that might have been eye-opening to you as well as you kind of looked at this book and
It was eye-opening to look at the background of him preparing. First of all, the speech, the eloquence of the speech itself will speak for itself. It is an unbelievably eloquent speech when he says, "We shall overcome." But before he says that, "I speak for the dignity of man," you know. But the background of it and how consciously he realized he was putting his presidency on the line and how he knew it was going to change the partisan structure of politics in the whole United States, and he did it anyway. And the reasons he did that are pretty amazing. He was so sure-footed on the subtleties of how to extend liberty for the fundamental right to vote that's at the heart of the American promise, and so eloquent that when he then, in the very same month, sends 50,000 Marines to Vietnam, knowing that he's likely to have stalemate, predicting that it's going to take 500,000 soldiers and win at best stalemate, and that he doesn't want to do it and it makes chills run up and down my spine, but he does it anyway because he said the American people will forgive you for anything but being weak and they'll run you out of office if you're a coward, so I've got to do it. It's a very, very complex portrait because I think he felt freedom much more deeply. His formative experiences as a teacher of Mexican-American student in Texas back in the 1920s really stayed with him in a way that I think most people's formative experiences do. I wonder where George Bush's formative experiences were in the Vietnam era because that's the era of civil rights and this. So, but the corresponding personal, deep personal feelings of Johnson stunned me in the book. They also make me very thankful for the record that we have of his private telephone conversations and sad that we won't have those for current presidents because eventually those historical records, in Johnson's case, allow you to humanize government struggling with very deep issues and see them as real people.
I mean, the idea that you're talking about, when he made this speech, we're talking about it was right around Selma and the struggle over the vote and the battles and his own interpersonal battles with Martin Luther King, which were just amazing.
Right, and George Wallace. He'd just met with King and Wallace at the same time. Not at the same time, but I mean in the same
moment.
Week. Same historical moment, and people think that he's going to have to send in the army to do this, and the Southern senators are saying to establish the right to vote down there will be a revolution, and we will rise up in the streets, and you will have to be a totalitarian dictator, and the economy will shrivel up, and the average garden variety white American won't have a chance. And our economy will shrivel. And he's saying, no, we have to do it anyway. And when he said we shall overcome, it was a jaw-dropping moment in American history. I mean, people in the Congress started cussing and not knowing what was going on. The mayor of Selma said every Southerner felt stabbed in the back because
every white Southerner,
that a Southern president would adopt the slogan of the civil rights movement on national television from the well of the Congress, and not just as a rhetorical advice. This was about landmark legislation that would take away from the states the right to govern who voted, who registered to vote. And basically it did that. It gave the vote to 5 million new black voters in the South.
And on the same time, as you talked about in terms of Vietnam, he was essaying a war, even though, as you described in the book, he wrestled with these moral issues himself and knew what he was doing was wrong, but he did it. Blows your mind when you read that, when he knew what he was doing would have ended up killing millions of people for no reason.
Right. And, you know, he's even talking with some of the same people about doing both of them, which is with McNamara, because McNamara, should we send troops in the South to enforce voting rights? And they say no, because it will offend the Southerners and it will do you more harm than good. It will provoke people. It will offend. So he's very sure-footed on the subtleties of the relationship between violence and power and democracy at home. But overseas, he knows that he's not going to be able to establish a political order among the Vietnamese, but he believes that violence will prevent the communists, hold off the communists from consolidating their control. And he says, if I don't do that, they'll call me a chicken and run me out of office. And he does it anyway.
Let's turn to Martin Luther King and his complexities as we talk to Taylor Branch about the final book in his trilogy on the King Years, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65 through 68. Now, you delved into deep into the lives of both Johnson and King. Some, I've read, have begun to criticize you in this book for painting the complexities of Martin Luther King, the man, and in his struggles as a man and some of the affairs he had. Now, when I heard those and I was reading through the book and trying to find them, and it's not as if you've kind of laced the book with King's affairs. I mean, you have to kind of find them buried in the pages where you kind of allude to things, except for that one piece about Coretta King, his wife, when he announced when she was ill about this affair he had. But so people criticize, A, why do you have to make that known? B, why was it important to the book? And what does it say to you about King the man and how it doesn't seem to blur for you the power he had as one of the most powerful figures in American history?
Well, King the man is real, and that's the truth. And King the man is really struggling. And in fact, as Coretta herself said, he was a guilt-driven man his whole life. And various forms of guilt affect people in different ways. I don't pretend to know, but I think there's a lot of evidence in King that one of the driving forces in his public life was almost to do penance for his... he said right from the pulpit, I'm not the saint everybody says I am. I'm a man just like you are. But lots of people in history have given us role models to believe that we can redeem ourselves. You know, St. Augustine, Martin Luther, Paul Tillich. He cited an awful lot of great figures in religious history who had their own private demons about sex and their inabilities to control them and that sort of thing, and who somehow worked them out or compensated on a large stage to try to do the best they could. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that's what King did too. Certainly, I tried to be selective about where it came in and used this when it was an issue in his life, when he felt that he was jeopardizing the movement and in his private discussions was trying to use this, was trying to protect the movement. And of course, you know, you can't be honest about the FBI trying to blackmail King if you're not honest about King having something to be blackmailed for. So, honesty of a very difficult subject is not just a two-way street; it's a 15-way street with King at the middle of the target here.
My guest is Taylor Branch, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the trilogy on the years, King Years. And what you did in these books was show the struggle in the White House and so the struggle inside the civil rights movement, wrestling with those issues every day. Republicans and Democrats inside the Democratic Party and inside the civil rights movement with different ideas about what that means. Take the civil rights movement. You dedicated the book to Diane Nash.
Yes.
Who was married to James Bevel.
Mm-hmm.
And you can describe who they are for our listeners rather than I doing that, and obviously. But this was part of the core of the debate over which way the movement, the civil rights movement, should go, in which direction it should go in. The King was in the center of, being pulled by the Student for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee on one end, and his own people around him in the SCLC on the other end. Describe a bit about these different ideas of freedom and the battles that took place inside the civil rights movement at that moment. They're really very critical, I think, to who we are now.
Yes, they are. And of course, there are so many of them. There are so many battles. They're constantly going. But one was over the Vietnam War.
Right.
Bevel wanted him to dedicate himself, said the civil rights movement is over. We got to end this war.
Who's a black minister, Bevel was.
Bevel is a black minister.
From
Itabena, Mississippi. Heard voices, considered crazy, and married to Diane, who was a Catholic beauty queen from Chicago, called an ice princess, and they were the two
African-American.
African-American, right. But very light-skinned, passed for white, and lots of people thought that it was a marriage that nobody could imagine. And yet they had this tempestuous relationship that produced the plan for the Selma Voting Rights Act. Then Bevel pushed King to get out of the war. All of King's advisors were against it, to come out against the Vietnam War. And he wound up from a long series of circumstances that had to do with Bevel having a vision in his washing machine, among many, many other things, saying that he was going to make this speech because he had promised Bevel. Because King said that you have to be crazy to do what we're trying to do to establish democracy where it didn't exist before. You have to have a little of profit in you, and that the whole argument in the movement is how to distinguish between self-destructively crazy and crazy and creatively crazy. So all of these things to me are just so wonderful going all the way through. Now I thought when I started the book that King was wrong to do the Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, as opposed to doing what Bevel wanted him to do and Joan Baez and many others wanted him to do, which was to do an all-out march on Washington to shut it down until they end the Vietnam War. He wanted to do the Poor People's Campaign, and it was the last great decision
right.
that he made. If I had ever had a chance to interview him, that's the one thing I would have asked first. But King, they had this huge debate, and I came at it from the standpoint of a former college student who was in the anti-war movement, and we thought that was the most important thing in ending the war, which is what a big, huge faction in the movement was felt. But King ultimately decided that as important as ending the war was, that essentially it was polarizing, but of course everything was polarizing, but it was a negative message to government to stop doing what you're doing. And that's all it could ever be, and that he felt that the Poor People's Campaign reverted to the theme of the civil rights movement, that we can rise up and live out the meaning of the American creed through our national politics by tackling problems of liberty that are deemed to be impossible, and that segregation was one, voting rights was one, the freedom rights, they were all appeals to the government to answer these searing problems with, you know, put them in the hamper of liberty and deal with them. And he decided that the Poor People's Campaign was in that tradition, and that even if he didn't have a chance of winning the battles then, that it would be a legacy that we're going to, you know, we believe we can address poverty, too. We can, I believe that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed and work a miracle with poverty, too.
Well, Taylor, when you get so deeply into the nuances of the interpolitical, interpersonal battles around King and around Johnson, and you can see what they were arguing about and what they argued about over the war in Vietnam, the arguments over segregation, the arguments over how to fight for freedom in America. What do you think it does to you and then to us, because we read what you write, about the what those nuances do, about how they change our view of the world, but they change your view of the world? I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing when you have this larger view of history and see, you know, civil rights struggle, Johnson, the war.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing the nuances here. You're seeing the really horrid, sometimes interesting battles around Martin Luther King that took place. The same thing around Johnson and the war and civil rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are vicious debates and fights that took place internally these people. What did that do to you to understand all of that and for us to understand all of that?
It enthralls me to be an American. It makes me feel lucky, even though there's so much, there's a lot of cruelty and freedom, and there's no guarantee that we can keep freedom. But to see people struggling with it at that level of detail, to me, is the best part of our birthright. And it makes me sad that we don't do the same thing now. Most people are passive, or they see politics as entertainment or cynicism, just as something. But it really affects everyday life. I mean, the South used to be a place where terrorism was quite prevalent and omnipresent in when it wasn't as a threat. It was a different place. You were afraid if you saw an integrated meeting that violence was not far away.
Mm-hmm.
That everyday life is so far removed. What to me is sad is that we take that for granted and don't realize that that came about from everyday struggle, people struggling over this. That's nonviolence. That's what democracy is made of.
And that's the core for you, this nonviolent piece of this core.
Oh, absolutely.
For you.
And it was the most powerful idea in the civil rights movement and the first one to become passé, the first one to be ridiculed across the board, starting with Malcolm X from the left. You know, nonviolence is for children and sissies. But then by everybody else, and it was repudiated by Black Power. Stokely Carmichael repudiated nonviolence after going to jail nonviolently for 6 years to win the right to vote. And then he, sadly to me, repudiated the right to vote, having sacrificed almost as much as anybody. I mean, Stokely in Lowndes County, to me, is the most poignant story in the whole book.
I agree.
In some respects, because he suffered so much. It took so much guts to go in there where no Black person had voted in the whole 20th century, where you couldn't even talk about voting without risking your life. And he survived a year. In 1 year, he took these people and inspired them not only to register to vote, but to learn the offices and even want to run for office.
And they almost won.
And
they came
almost
close to
win. And they almost won in 1966, the first time they ever voted. And he got no credit for that. And he was attacked for doing it. He was seen as because he didn't want to do it in the Democratic Party as sectarian and this, that, and the other. And it was very sad to see him finally revolt.
Taylor, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65 through 68. We'll come back to Taylor and more of this in the near future. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman, and our editor is Elizabeth Buckle at Clean Cuts. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gabe Pinder, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.